This is an interview with William G. Ebersole, conducted on August 16th, 2010, at Mr. Ebersole's residence in Gainesville. The interviewer is Robert Zeger. Good morning, Mr. Ebersole. Thanks for agreeing to do this interview. While our focus is on your experience during World War II, I'd like to know something about your life before the war, so we'll start in the teenage years.
Okay.
So we would like to know something about your family, your upbringing and education, where you grew up, what life was like in Arcadia, and so forth.
It's a small town in South Florida, about 60 miles south of Lakeland, Arcadia. And I was born there and raised there and graduated from high school in DeSoto County High School in Arcadia. I started newspaper work when I was 4 years old. My father would take me down to the paper at 4 o'clock in the morning on publication day. And I sat on top of a couple stacked up boxes, and the paper that would come off the press, an old mealy, they called it an old mealy press, and it would split the pages as they came off the press, so they inserted them different ways after they were split. But I had to sit at the tall bed and catch the papers as they came off and keep them from piling up in the middle. Separated, they had a metal divider there, and I'd sit there and do that. And so I'd work once a week for him, and I got 5 cents an hour. I remember he gave me a nickel an hour, and I thought I was so great.
That's pretty good wages in the 30s.
but I did that periodically, not every week. But
was your father then in the newspaper business?
Oh yes, my father was an owner at that time of the Arcadian, a weekly newspaper.
I see.
And I was raised in the weekly newspaper plant. I had my first, I told you about my first job, but my first real job was a paper route. And I started when I was 6 years old, going out once a week on publication day and soliciting subscribers to the Arcadian, and I'd hand deliver those. And I did that till I got out of high school. Every Thursday I'd go down and have me a route of 100, 125 customers, and I'd do it on my bicycle. I bought my first bicycle when I was in the second grade. I remember it was a Schwinn. I had a little toolbox underneath the crossbar on it, but I really enjoyed that. But I think I paid $17 for it, but it was really, really nice. But I did that, and then they went. Well, I went on through high school. I was involved in most of the athletics. I did a lot of different things. I never was what you call it, expert in any of them. In high school, I was on the football team. I was a quarterback, weighed 125 pounds, and I think I started one game in my whole career. I used to enjoy going out and playing scrimmage and everything, but I was so little, and I tried hard. I got injured a couple of times, nothing real serious. But
Did you win that game?
No, the one I started didn't. We lost. We lost the game. I mean, we played in Palmetto, Florida, but at that time where we're located, we played against Lakeland and Sarasota and Fort Myers, Punta Gorda. All these are huge cities down there now. And so, they've since grown, and Arcadia's not, it's doubled in size since I was there, but not much more than that.
Did your mother work outside the home?
No, she stayed at home. She had worked some before she got married, but she didn't ever work outside the home.
Was your family native Floridian, or had they moved from elsewhere?
My father came from Iowa. And he came to Florida with one of his World War I buddies, and he met my mother when he was down here, and they got married after about 3 or 4 months, and they went back to Iowa. And so my brother was born in Iowa. They'd been married about a year, year and a half when he was born. And then they came on back down to Florida. They got through the cold winters a couple of years. But he was from Iowa. He was from Manson, Iowa, I think is where he was born.
I see.
But he had been working up in Des Moines. My mother was is a native Floridian. She was born in Ocala. I'm pretty sure it was Ocala. But I know she was raised in Ocala and then moved down to Arcadia with her father and her family.
You have the one brother. Do you have other siblings?
I have had one brother 2 years older and a brother 2 years younger. And then I had a sister that was 10 years younger than I was.
I see.
A latecomer. She died in 19, after she was about I guess 31 or 32 years old with the Sears virus. They never did exactly find out what it was. Sad. She'd been married and had 4 children.
Oh.
And I haven't kept up with the children very well in recent years.
Your brother's still with us?
My older brother died about a year and a half ago. And my younger brother is still living. He's married, living down in Lakeland.
I see.
His son is a physician at the Lakeland, a special heart surgeon.
Yeah,
in Lakeland,
and your family lived in you grew up in the one community. Your family didn't
move
around.
Yeah, we didn't move around at all.
Yeah. Before thinking about World War II, you were born, I think, in 1924. Would that be right?
1924. Yeah.
So that would make you 15 at the time of the outbreak of World War II in Europe.
Right.
How aware were you as a young man, well, and someone in the newspaper business
things. I did read the paper a lot even then. I'd go out and get the paper every morning and read it early. I was kind of an early riser and always have been, but I kept up with the paper that way, with the news. I wasn't particularly worried about the war because I was so distant from it. I didn't have at that time have any close friends, anybody going off to war. By the time I got out of high school, some of my classroom then started going off. When I went off to college, and some of them were joining the services then.
But by then, the war, would have been in the war by then.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was, I graduated from high school in June the 6th, 1942.
I see.
Yeah, and then I worked that summer and came up to the university in September of 42. And then I joined the Air Corps Reserve on October 31st. I remember that date, but I joined the Air Force Reserve. 4 of us went out of the dorm section at the university. We lived in Fletcher L, and we all went down to the Air Corps office together. And I was the only one that passed everything.
I see.
And it was kind of funny because when I was about 6-7 years old, I got shot in the eye with a BB gun.
Oh.
And I had my patch over my eye for about 6 weeks. And it apparently it hit my eyeball and made a pure hole coming out my eyelid. And I said, they won't take me because I got bad eyes. but it all healed and I got through that all right. And so I was only past all the physicals. And I joined, they swore me in the reserve on the 31st of October.
1942.
And I did that because everybody said, you know, this war may be over in a year or so. And if we just get a couple years of college, maybe we'll be able to. They won't have to go to war. And I said, that sounds great to me.
let me back up just a little bit and ask you about Pearl Harbor. Do you remember where you were or remember here?
Yeah, all I remember is that we came home from Sunday school. I think it was on a Sunday.
Yeah.
So I came home from Sunday school, and my father was glued to the radio and heard about the Pearl Harbor thing. We were all kind of worried about it then. He was because he was a veteran of World War I. He didn't have any overseas duty. He was a pilot.
Was he?
Well, he was training in pilot. And hadn't really gotten very far with it when the war was over, so they just didn't disband the program.
Yeah.
But he was a trainee, and it's where he met the friend that brought him down to Arcadia.
Why, when, as you said, you were at the University of Florida, you joined the Air Corps Reserve.
Yes.
Why Air Force? Why not the Navy, the Army?
It just seemed logical to me because I said, now, if you get in the Army, you're going to feel any of those, you're going to be up in the front line on the ground.
Uh-huh.
I said, I'd rather get somewhere where I can be a little more distant from that.
See.
I'd rather be in the background, you know, somewhere away from all that action. It was kind of radical the way it worked out. But that was my plan. Uh-huh. And then when I got in and started going through the training, I really got interested. I really liked flying. I'd never flown before. I went through my first flight in primary flight school.
So your choice to go into the Air Corps really didn't have anything to do with your father's experience?
Not really.
Particularly.
Not really.
Yeah.
He was pretty quiet about his experience.
Yeah,
I saw some pictures of it, but he didn't get very far in his training anyway.
And he didn't remain a pilot? He didn't
No, he never did really, never did fly.
Yeah, I see.
He never did get his.
Okay. I was impressed from reading some of the background material that they gave me about you was the extent and apparent rigor of the training that you underwent during World War II.
It was magnificent when you look back on it and see that they can take all of us young folks And of course, the university group that went down to Miami Beach together, there were about, several hundred of us went down there. We left on, they told us to report on February 24th, 1943. And that was just the start of the second semester, had just started. And I had to get cleared out of the university, get down there, have about a 10-day vacation. I don't remember exactly how many days. But then went on down, caught a bus, went down to Miami Beach to report in.
And you were now, you were now out of the university Army Air Corps,
Yeah. But I was trying to stay distant from all that action. And my brother was very interested in airplanes and could hear an airplane and tell you what kind it was and all that. And I didn't pay that much attention to it. And it's kind of funny that I was my younger brother.
I see.
But I was kind of interested in it and got into it. And the more I got into it, the more I liked it.
Your other brother is also at sea service during World War II?
Yeah, my older brother was in the field artillery. He went through the university training. He's 2 years ahead of me. And when they called in that group into the service, and he got into a flight training for these little Cubs, the Piper Cubs. Yeah. I don't know what they call them, L-5s, I think. I don't remember exactly what they call them, but he was flying one of those. Got shot down 3 different times.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. And he had 3 different crashes. And he was, after the war, he was in Walter Reed Hospital in Washington. Oh, I guess for a year and a half, 2 years.
Wow.
He had some got hit on the head pretty bad with some of the crashes. And he had blackouts, and they couldn't really find out what it was causing. Wow. He came back to school under full retirement. And I had a couple of close calls with him it's a little aside, but I went out one morning. I was working my way through college and with the help of the GI Bill.
This is after the war.
Yeah, after the war. And I was staying, the 6 of us were living together in a house right across from what used to be the drill field, which is now the Odo. Right across University Avenue from there was a 4-unit apartment. And they had a garage in the back that I think it had 4 or 5 stalls for cars. And they had an apartment above the garage. 6 of us lived there, but I went out to go to work one morning at 6 o'clock, and he was lying out there laying. Looked to me like he was looking underneath the car. The engine was running. And he was laying underneath, I thought that's what he was, and he had fallen in his shirt sleeve, and his shirt had caught on the bumper, and his face was in front of the exhaust.
He
was
just black.
He had been out there for hours. Wow. And if I hadn't been out there when I did, I would pile him in my car and rushed him to the hospital.
Wow.
And he was in the hospital about 2 or 3 weeks. But he got through that all right, but he had quite a few close calls.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's something that happened after
I see. Your younger brother?
No, older also, brother.
But was your younger brother in the service?
No, younger brother hadn't come. He came to college. He went into the service for about a year and was studying photography.
I see.
And then came back. Yeah. And then later on, he took over the newspaper. After my father was alive until 1952. My daughter was born in 54. She was 2 years old when my father died. He died from a heart attack. But in the meantime, he had asked me to, I'd graduated from college in 49. And he asked me to come back. And my brother said, no, he'd rather. He said he would like the option of coming back also. And I said, I had a good job then at the newspaper here. And I said, well, you go ahead and do that if you want to, and I'll go back to Gainesville.
Yeah.
And that's when I came back up here. Yeah. Got married in 1950. I graduated in August of 49, and we got married in August the 6th of 1950. So we've been married now for 61 years.
Good for you.
Yeah.
I just celebrated my 48th.
Yeah. Well, it's a long... my wife's been ill with Alzheimer's. The doctor told her at the end, in December of 40, of 50, I get my way back. December of 99, that she couldn't drive anymore. That he diagnosed her illness as Alzheimer's. Mm. And she was then having some pretty serious problems getting lost, not knowing where she was. So she had Alzheimer's now since about 1997. And so she's had it now 12 or 13 years. And lately, she's been doing fine. I mean, she does. She knows me. Will smile. She can't talk anymore. She's totally incontinent. Can't hardly take her anywhere. And so that's kind of where we are with that.
Yeah.
And we don't know how long that's going to last.
It's a sad business, I know.
Yeah. Not much you can do.
Well, we kind of got ahead of the war. Well, that's fine. I mean, this is your interview. But maybe we could talk a bit about your actual postings and the actual training that you underwent. You said it was rigorous and you were impressed with it.
Yeah, they had a and I don't know, I don't have the dates all.
That's not so important.
But we, after I left, I went to Miami Beach for a month. And they were being indoctrinated, checked out, and got all our equipment and everything. And then they sent some of us to his college training detachment. And I went to Clemson, South Carolina, both be there for 4 months. But at the end of 3 months, I was pulled out of the Clemson and joined the group, but really ahead of the group that I was with there, a month ahead. I was in class of 44D. That means D being the fourth month.
I see.
In 1944.
And then from Clemson to where?
Clemson to what they call a pre-flight training in Maxwell Field in Montgomery, Alabama. And that's where they teach a lot of ground school and do a lot more investigating. And
you're still not flying yet.
No, this class, you're still going through classification to find out.
I see.
The choices were becoming a bombardier, a navigator, or a pilot. And I was trying to stay on the pilot side if I could. But I went through the classification. And then they, and I'm a little bit rusty on exactly when, but after we left there from training, we went to primary flight school. And my primary, I had been with these groups of folks from college here at the university, and they all went to primary schools in Arkansas and in Mississippi. And I, as a sole person, was sent to Arcadia, Florida for primary flight.
Is that right?
And I don't know yet. Nobody ever told me what happened, but somehow my father had a partner in, that he worked with that was heavily involved with doing printing for the Air Corps. They did a bunch of little brochures and things. And they knew somebody, but they pulled me out of that and put me in Arcadia, which was wonderful because all these other people, I hunted and fishing, fished all the rivers and creeks and streams around there. I knew everything by heart. I knew where all the lakes were. Yeah. And so I could do it. I just was really much, very much at home. But that's where I got my primary flight school. I had an unusual thing happen in that after I'd had, the plan was for each of the cadets to get 60 hours of flight training. And once you solo, then you started working on your different phases. The first phase was what we call a soloing, and you're supposed to do that after 20 hours and do some basic maneuvers. And then the 20 to 40 hours, we did chandelles and lazy eights and things like that, loops. And
what kind of aircraft was this?
It was a Stearman PT-17, a Stearman trainer. It's a bi-wing planer.
How would you spell Stearman?
S-T-E-A-R-M-A-N.
I said that for the transcriber.
Okay. Well, it's a Stearman PT-17. It's an open cockpit, it had two seaters. The instructor would sit in the front seat and the student would sit in the back seat. And I believe that's the way it was. Maybe I got it backwards, but I don't remember. But anyway, after I had about 30 hours, our instructor resigned or left, the instructor I'd had up to that point. And so they sent people around to check and give us check rides. And normally after you've had 40 hours, you get the check rides. Well, they did the check rides and they passed me. They said, okay, you've passed your 40-hour check ride.
Now, a check ride is...
It's where they just find out if you're ready to go one step further than the next step.
Yeah.
And if people that weren't ready, that couldn't make it, they would wash out. But they said, you passed your 40-hour check ride, so you can start on acrobatics. They did acrobatics and all. And so from 30 hours to 60 hours, I had 30 hours. Some of these guys didn't get through their 40-hour check ride. They have 45 or 50 hours. and they had 10 hours of acrobatics. I had 30 hours of acrobatics, and I loved it. I just loved all the acrobatics.
Yeah. Now, this is soloing by now?
Oh, soloing, yes. Yeah, it's almost 100% solo.
So how did you, I didn't ask this, but how did you feel about that? Obviously, you were attracted to flight, yet I can imagine... I would be frightened having control of this plane.
I don't remember ever being frightened the whole time I was in the Air Corps. And I mean, a lot of things we did, but it never bothered me as being frightened. And looking back on it, I think most of us just thought, you know, problems, other people had problems, we didn't have them. We were invincible. They say that's what's wrong with all these young folks. But no, I never had any problem with that at all. And just looking forward to getting up in the airplane, and we do it at the acrobatic stage. We do a snap roll, which is obviously full left rudder and full right stick at the same time. And then you're in the airplane, do a complete snap, a complete roll. But and sometimes you can make it do a double roll. You can kick it into a tailspin and then recover from it. And then we had a Immelmann turns, loops, and slow rolls. All this was just a lot of fun. And you really enjoy it. You get used to it. But we left, I had about a little over 60 hours, and I went into was transferred to Gunner Field, Selma, Alabama. We had some Gunner Field in Selma for basic training. And we used the BT-13 basic training. That's what I knew it as. I would have to look and see what it, I don't even know who made it, but it's a standard BT-13. And then we got another 60 hours, approximately 60 hours there. And we did a little bit of formation flying, not much. We did a lot of navigation and instrument flying. They started teaching us all that. And then when we got through that phase, I went to Selma Field Craig Field in Selma, Alabama, and went for the AT-6. I had an opportunity after I got out of a basic. They were getting a handful of pilots to send them to New York or to the Air Corps. What is it? But it was the. Anyway, they wanted me to join the group and go into twin engine training, and I'll think of it in a minute before I get.
Would that be the P-38s?
P-38 is a fighter.
Oh, I see.
In training. Yeah. Instead of training with the anyway, I chose not to go into twin engine. I just felt like I was young and I wanted to be responsible for getting me out of an airplane, not worrying about anybody else. We had to get out.
I see.
So I stayed with a single engine. Then I transferred to, in advanced training, we had a lot of formation flying. We had a lot of gunnery training. We'd go down to Eglin Field and practice. You know, you had guns under 30 caliber guns that mattered in each wing, one in each wing, in the AT-6 training. And then we did some lower level flying and getting pretty well ready to get us into the advanced. I did have 10 hours of P-40. It was my first a real fighter training. We spent 2 or 3 weeks at Eglin Field in Selma, at Eglin Field in northwest Florida, doing gunnery work, ground gunnery and aerial gunnery both. They'd drag a target for aerial gunnery, and then we'd shoot ground gunnery on the ground gunnery range here. Then I got sent down to Tallahassee for 6 weeks, interim, waiting for a place to open up, and then they sent me down to Bartow, Florida, P-51 training.
The P-51 was relatively new, wasn't it?
It'd been around, but they're just in the process of remodeling it. Most of our training was done in Model A, B, and C, P-51. But starting with the Model D, these had a canopy was built in part of the fuselage, and the pilot was sitting in part of the fuselage. The P-51D had a bubble canopy.
I see.
And that was a much more visibility. Of course, with no ribs and all around it. And they had it air conditioned, and those P-51A particularly was one of the first ones, and it was very hot. we flew that some in training in Bartow. And most of my flight training was in Bartow and in the A, B, or C. I only had a few hours of P-51B.
I can remember as a kid during World War II, I can remember this, is the three planes that I remembered were the P-47 Thunderbolt, the P-38 Lightning, and the P-51 Mustang.
Right.
They call it Mustang. I don't know if you call it that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we did. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's kind of where my training went. I stayed in Bartow with my whole group, and then actually my roommate and I, he was a third-year student at Princeton when he joined the Air Corps. A little bit older than I was, but I'd take him down to Arcadia to get him dates and all this. And he was a very sharp guy. He really liked him a lot. In fact, he told me one time, he said, you know, watch me. He said, I'm going to be president of the United States one day. And he'd play bridge and spread out his hands and never adjust his cards at all. I have trouble enough counting things. But out there, he got a fantastic memory. But he was really great. But anyway, we figured out, we would spend our time figuring out what it took to hit the aerial target. And we had figured out where we could, they'd tow a target out over off of Clearwater. It'd be about a 40-foot long target, 6 feet high, about 6 feet high, might have been 8 feet. But it's a wire mesh, and they dip the bullets, the nose of them, in a chalky paint, and you would leave a trace of chalk when you hit it. And so we did all these things, and finally figured out that most of these guys were shooting back here. We said, we got to shoot here, to shoot the target at more at right angles, so you got a much better view. And he and I together had the highest gunnery score of any of the pilots at that time. And we figured that's probably why the two of us plus two other guys had been, might have been four other guys, but four or five of us got pulled out of the class about to leave Bartow and moved over to Lakeland to this 506 fighter group that was in training. It was a new group they started up specifically to do extra long range missions. And that's what we did. We joined the long range. I'll show you an article here. That's the P-51 and the VLR. They call it very long range. This is the plane that we flew.
Beautiful planes.
Yeah.
Beautiful planes.
You'd recognize those. That was I participated in the. Well, this is the plane that I flew there.
This is the P-51D.
Yeah, P-51D.
Yeah, and for I'm trying to. Mr. Ebersole showing us a book on the very long range P-51 Mustang, and yeah. It's
happened. I'd been in touch. Carl Molesworth contacted me, so I have some of my pictures in that book.
Written by Carl Molesworth,
yeah.
And we're looking at this. I'm doing this for the recording.
Okay.
We're looking at this book, and there are pictures of Mr. Ebersole in the book itself.
Yeah, I'll show you a couple of them. But that's my airplane. I've underlined some of this.
Uh-huh.
And if you, this is the plane that I flew. And that gives you just a rough idea of what some of the stuff in that one I marked.
And so you were in training for, I guess it would be long-range bomber support,
well,
I guess.
That's what they started doing in Lakeland. They've been in Lakeland, the group there had been in training already for 6 or 8 weeks. When we joined it.
How far would we be now? We'd be toward the end of 43 or even into 44?
Well, 44D, April 44, I graduated from flying school. And so then in April, and we were down in training in Bartow probably in June, July. I've got my flight log.
It doesn't matter so much, so that we keep the
But it turned out that they didn't have a need for a lot of pilots at that time, and the 60 hours we're supposed to get in Bartow ended up, I had over 200 hours in Bartow. But my roommate, I told you, such an eager beaver, he and I were volunteering for everything. In fact, they even, as we got toward the end of our training there, we volunteered as tow targets for some of the other pilots.
I see.
But just a long time. We felt like the more time we could put in, the safer it would be and the better it would be for us.
Yeah.
So we logged a lot, as much time as we could.
Yeah.
But it was a, we stayed, we left and joined the group in Lakeland and left right at the first of the 45. They split, the group, because they knew the missions were going to be so long, they split they split's not a good word. They doubled the number of pilots assigned to each squadron. And the best I could recollect or tell now, looking backward, was that we had about 40 pilots per squadron. When our normal contingency, you have 16 planes to try to keep in the air. Normal contingency was for about 20 pilots. But they didn't want us flying 8-hour missions 2 days in a row.
I see.
Our missions were running about 8 hours. And from the time you take off to the time you land. So you take off at 8 in the morning and stay in that little cockpit until 4 in the afternoon when you brought it back.
Yeah.
And that's when it was all over water flight over the open Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
And then you got there and the people were shooting at you. So you earned your... but that was the... And I didn't have any real... in heavy contact in my time with planes. The main reason we didn't encounter very many airborne planes was that we had had some of the two of the groups. There was three P-51 groups on Iwo Jima and one P-47 group.
Let's get you to Iwo Jima before you tell me about this. So you finished your training in Florida. In
Florida, and then I went. We shipped out. That's where we half of the pilots there. I went one route to go join out to San Francisco to get on an aircraft carrier that carried all of our planes. The other half of us went to Seattle, Washington, got on an old hospital ship that had been reconverted to Bloemfontein, it was called, and went to Hawaii and taken a circular route. We got to Iwo about 6 weeks before the pilots did. The pilots stopped in Tinian in Saipan. And unloaded the planes and started flying them out of Tinian before we were on Iwo about 6 weeks before we ever saw our airplane.
I see.
So, but that was part.
You were the group coming out of Seattle.
I was the group coming out of Seattle.
Yes, okay. And then you got to Iwo Jima.
Ahead of the pilots.
And that would have been in the spring of 45?
No, I flew my first mission at the end of June, at the end of May. 45.
And that was just after the end of the...
Well, of course, the Marines landed there on February the 19th, 45. And then they didn't have the island secured completely. We were right at the tail end of that when they were secured.
In May.
We still have the Japanese that were holed up in some of the caves and all and running out. And it was scary the first few weeks we were there because they were still... Machine guns would go off in the middle of the night and everybody was on edge. And we had in the 21st, I believe it was the 21st fighter group, that had been there about a month. Some Japanese came out of hiding and ran down through the encampment there, their tents, and threw in hand grenades and killed a dozen pilots.
Really?
And we were out sitting out off the island in a boat, and you could see all these flares going up, and we knew something was going on. Because they were there earlier, they got a lot more activity. By the time we got up in the air, the Japanese had pretty well decided that they were outnumbered and outgunned. Our planes were so much superior to theirs, they quit coming up after us. And that's when we started doing more strafing, attacking transportation on the ground and in the waters around Tokyo. All this.
Yeah. So you would have been on Iwo Jima for a month or so before your planes arrived.
Yeah, a couple of months.
And then you did most of your activity was still in that area. There was
there's not there wasn't any but there, Chichi Jima, which is where the first President Bush was shot down. And he was a naval pilot. And they still had a radio station there and had a little airstrip there. And my first two missions I flew were, first one mission, I guess, was from Iwo Jima. It's about a 45-minute flight to Chichijima. And I dropped 500-pound bombs on two different occasions toward the air station there.
Had you been trained to dropping bombs as well as gunnery itself?
Yes. We did some, and they had a gunnery range at, when I was in Bartow over in Avon Park. And we did practice skip bombing as well as dive bombing.
I see. Do you recall how it felt flying your first or your early combat missions? I asked you before if you were at all afraid. You said you were never afraid while you were flying.
No, we had so much we had to do.
I see.
You have to look at the cockpit of a P-51. You can see what I'm talking about because there's so many things you have to keep up with. And we had a job to do, and we just routinely did it. We never suffered, we never suffered serious serious losses because of enemy fire or planes. We did have some serious losses because of weather. When you go that far and pass a couple fronts all the way, that's about 650 miles, and you know, a lot can be between you and the target. And a lot of times, on June the 1st, 1945, our group lost 20. No, they had all three groups on the mission to Japan lost 29 planes and 27 pilots on one weather mission. And there's something on that. I just started reading it the other day on the computer. But there's something on there in the 506 fighter group on the computer. It would tell you in great detail the reports of all the pilots that went on that. Because we had, I missed that mission because I went through every other mission.
I see.
And this was my mission to miss.
Would this have been bomber escort?
We intended for it to be bomber escort. And the bombers were able to go through the weather, but the P-51s don't have the weather capability that the big bombers do.
I mean, that's why they were flying such a long distance?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, the bombers, Iwo is about halfway between the Tinian, Guam, and Saipan, that group of islands where the bombers were all located. In one of those three places, they'd come by Iwo, and we'd pick them up in Iwo and fly into Japan with them.
Did you do many missions over Japan?
I had 10 of the very long range missions.
I see.
And these constituted probably a whole lot more hours than over in Europe. You know, they could get off and be back at the base an hour and a half after doing a mission. With us, we took off and we had all the concerns of that, of fuel concerns, of weather concerns, that were really serious.
But by that time, there was less of a concern over enemy action.
That's right. And so for that reason, after my second mission, I believe it was, that I started we would go in and be assigned an airfield to strafe. And we would drop down to 15,000 feet, come across the airfield, 12 planes abreast, looking for any kind of, mostly for airplanes. And I did get credit for a couple of airplanes destroyed on the ground. We would drop down 15,000 feet at full throttle. We were going fast. And we didn't lose very many planes doing that because they didn't think we could go that fast. But P-51 was a real great airplane.
At the beginning of the war, correct me if I'm wrong here, this is just what I thought I knew, the Japanese Zero was pretty much state-of-the-art, was better than most of the American planes.
Except that we wouldn't have, the Japanese planes were much lighter weight. And our planes were fast, much faster. And we could, they were inline engine, had a lot of power. We had a 12-cylinder, 1,500-horsepower engine, and it was you couldn't keep up with it. Our tactics mostly were not to get in a plane-to-plane dogfight with them because they could turn inside of us. And in order to be able to shoot us, they've got to be able to put the nose of their plane way, way in front of where we are, and we run into the village. But they were shooting behind us. They didn't understand that. We lost some planes to combat, but not very many.
Early in the war, it wasn't so, I mean, as I understand it, at Midway, we lost an enormous number
of
planes.
Right. Yeah.
So it was really the training of the pilots.
Their training was far superior. Yeah. And in that part of the war, which was the last 4 months of the war, their pilot trainees were not that good.
They lost so many pilots in the early stages of the war. Yeah. Are there any particular experiences in combat that stand out? I understand that you played a role or got a Japanese ship.
Yeah, I did. We were assigned to strafe an airfield. The airfield was closed in. We couldn't strafe it, and our squadron found a train in a train station, and so we started making passes at the train. I shot hell out of caboose, and they realized it was backing up and not going forward. And sometimes they'd put the engines in the center of the train instead of the front or the back. But I did get some hits on it. But we left there, and my flight leader says, "Come on, Bill, let's get out of here. We're going to run into one of our people if we don't watch out." There's several other people had found the train station the same time we had. And so we went out on the inland sea, and found what we call a sugar dog, about 100, 125-foot boat chugging along.
Sugar dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We called it, and I don't know what, but that's what the name we had for it. And my flight leader made a pass on the boat. Well, this was right down my alley, because I really had such a high score in gunnery training in Bartow, was that I knew how to do that. I leveled up my plane and centered the ball, which meant that it wasn't skewing side to side, because skewing this way, you miss it. And then I put down 10 degrees of flaps and pulled the throttle back a little bit and kind of glided in on it. And I made one pass, and my flight leader says, his name's Jose Diaz. Jose said, "Bill, let's go again." I said, "Okay." So we circled around one more time, and each made a second pass on the boat. And I got credit for most of the hits on it. But it was I worry about that, because I know that people on the boat and all this.
I was going to ask you about that. It sounds like such a silly, civilian, naive question to ask. Did it cross your mind about the people who were on the receiving end?
If I was on the boat, I jumped overboard, and I'd got in behind the boat and under the water. Uh-huh. And I don't know what they did. I didn't see that. So I don't know what they did.
Did you think about that at all?
Not at that time, no.
Subsequently? But
my job was to sink the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. You are a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross.
Yes. It sounds on the surface a lot different than it actually is. They gave us an air medal. These medals were awarded based on the extreme hazardous mission to fly over that much water and to then go into combat situation on Japan, and then to fly all the way back to a little dot of an island out in the Pacific Ocean. And they felt that was so hazardous it warranted extra recognition. So they gave us the air medal on our first, fourth, seventh, and tenth missions. That means I got four air medals. And then on the tenth mission, they gave you a Distinguished Flying Cross. And just for being there and making all your missions. And there wasn't that many people in our group that made that by the war's end. But again, I was my Eager Beaver roommate and I got in on everything we could. And we ended up with I've got to tell you at this point that Al Colley, my roommate, was killed 3 months after the war, flying a P-47 that he wasn't accustomed to.
Wow. The man from Princeton?
Yep.
He thought he might be president one day?
Yep. He was killed. He tried to, but he was kind of reckless in many ways. He would, one thing you don't do is, if you want to do a slow roll, you don't do it close to the ground on takeoff. And he did that. It didn't hurt him. He got through it. But I would never do that. I'm not that reckless. But and on some of his missions, he did get credit for shooting one plane down. But we were wingmen, and our job was to stay with our flight, our element leader. And he didn't do that. He saw a Japanese plane, he took off, started chasing it. And that's the sort of thing he was doing. So he was kind of reckless, and it cost him.
The thing we read often about the young men who flew these planes in World War II, the RAF during the Battle of Britain and so on, and they have the reputation of being young, maybe risk takers, very aggressive.
Some of that is true. Somebody told me since the war. That the reason they got so many, so they liked to have the young pilots was because they thought they were immortal, and they said, I don't think their brain was fully developed at that age. I kind of believe that because we weren't, I wasn't living, we had 12 men living, 12 pilots, all second lieutenants, living in a Quonset hut together. And I don't know, well, I do know one guy that was very scared and upset.
There was one.
Only one guy I know of. The rest of it, when he signs up, he would take off and be gone about an hour and come back and say something matter with his airplane. He did that two or three times, and then after about the fourth or fifth mission that he actually completed, he refused to fly anymore. He said, you know, this is dangerous. Somebody could get killed doing this.
Yeah.
And he quit. They had already sent him back to Hawaii for a 2 weeks rest leave and thought that would cure it all, but it didn't.
But that was very rare.
Yeah.
Mostly
I won't even say what his name is, but I know it right.
Yeah, okay.
There weren't very many people that thought that. And I was always eager to get, I had enough confidence that I could look after myself. I found the one thing that probably helped me in my overseas duty, as much as anything, that I was an Eagle Scout. And I had a lot of outdoor experiences. And I felt pretty confident I could take care of myself. And I knew that. In fact, I would show you my little, I've got a little, kit. We made itself a little underneath. We flew with a backpack parachute, and then a seat on the sat on a dinghy folded up just the size of your seat. It's a one man dinghy that you could float with. We wore a May vest all the time. We had a pad right above the one man dinghy, about 2 inches thick, and it fit the size of the cushion. We put a zipper around it and started loading it up with survival gear. And after the war, I kept that, and I put it in my wife's attic down in Nocatee, Florida, 4 miles from Arcadia. And when her father died in 2002 or three, I found that down there. I'd forgotten about it, and I've still got it with all these survival stuff in it. I robbed out a few things out of it, but it was a complete, you know, in fact, I was at a high school one day some months ago, and I said, now, if you're going to want to protect yourself and go be floating around out in the Pacific Ocean, well, tell me some of the things you'd like to have. And then they'd say, well, I don't want to. And they started going there, and I said, here it is. And, you know, and that's about all we had to think about all this stuff that we had. But I had a complete, I had a sea dye, I had a little radar screen, I had fishing tackle, I had a bird shot that I carried, a 45 pistol, I had bird shot and tracer bullets to fit the 45 pistol. I had a rations, water supplies for 10 days. Had all sorts of, and still got the waters and the candy survival stuff. But it really makes an interesting exhibit. I'm going to try to get it on display somewhere and fix it up. But I think people might be interested in seeing all that kind of stuff.
I would imagine so, yeah. You were mustered out early in 46?
I left the service in the first week or 10 days in 46, and there's starting a new class for second semester at the University of Florida. And so I stayed out about a week before I went back to the university.
Now, when you started at the University of Florida several years before, you were going into civil engineering.
Yeah.
Did you pursue that?
I went back to civil engineering, and then I changed over to mechanical engineering after a semester. And then my wife was a pharmacist, so I changed over to pharmacy and stayed a year and a half in pharmacy.
Do you want to get that?
Yeah.
I was asking about your academic career at the University of Florida.
Okay, well, I got through the pharmacy. I took a year and a half of pharmacy. I had qualitative and quantitative analysis.
So you followed your wife into the pharmacy college.
And that didn't work too well for me. I wasn't that good in chemistry and all. And it looked like my grades weren't getting any better. And I said, well, I better look for the closest door. And that's what I did. I ended up going back into journalism and graduated with a journalism degree. After I got, that's when I was working at the Sun. I graduated in 49, in the summer of 49.
But I mean, just to sort of clarify or to sort of add to that in a way, it wasn't like journalism was it all along. In other words, you might expect that with your father and your brother and so on, but you kind of rediscovered journalism in a way.
Well, I did because I was just looking for I ended up with a journalism degree, but it has credits in quantitative analysis, uh-huh. Chemistry, organic chemistry.
I see.
And two other chemistry courses. And I thought living with a pharmacist, this would nice to have.
Yeah.
But it wasn't necessary. I graduated in 49, she graduated in 51. So she had one more course to take after we got married.
In those days, it wasn't, am I not right that she was something of a pioneer in pharmacy as a woman?
That she really was. She was early on. There's only four or five girls in the College of Pharmacy at that time.
What was her maiden name?
Cowart, Cowart.
Okay.
Yeah.
We were getting at...
After I graduated, when I was a student, I started working at the Gainesville Sun. I'd worked different jobs around, trying to make enough money to keep my car going in the GI Bill. And I took a job I worked at the old College Inn, I worked at the university, they had a little grill room at that time. And I worked an 11 to 1 shift. When I worked in the cafeteria, I worked from 6 to 8:30 for meals. The 11 to 1 shift was for meals. Then I took a job at Wise's at the Florida Theater downtown, and I worked on weekends ushering. I worked about 12, 15 hours a week. And then I was getting 50 cents an hour, and they increased the next door I'd worked as a soda jerk in high school. So I took a job at the Wise's drugstore next door. And I worked for 60 cents an hour doing sodas. And then I found out I'd learned to operate the linotype machine, which is a hot metal line casting machine. And I started, got a job at the Gainesville Sun for 75 cents an hour. And I thought, that's a whole lot better.
And the Sun at that time was downtown.
It was downtown.
In what's now a shopping area.
Yeah,
now,
uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that was a, and so I started with the Sun along in 1948. And then when I graduated in 49, I had a full-time job in the production department in linotype, operating, but it was on the night shift. And so after 3 or 4 months of working full-time on linotype, the general manager came up to see me one night, I remember, and said, would you like to go in the ad department? And it used to be a daytime job, but it's kind of hard to have a nighttime job and try to do your courting and other things. Yeah. So I said, sure, I'd be glad to. I wasn't ever trained in advertising, but I trained in news writing and editing. But it all worked out fine because I did take a job in advertising. It was a real void there, so there's no... I was the advertising manager. I had to be over there for about a year. And anyway, then I started up the ladder in the production department into advertising. And then in 1962, Look Magazine bought the Gainesville Sun. And Gardner Coles, that owned the Des Moines Register and Tribune and the Minneapolis Star Tribune, bought the Sun. And his son-in-law came down from Harvard and started running it. And he left to go to Lakeland in 40, that was in 62. In 65, he left Gainesville, went down there, and I became the general manager of the paper when he went down there. It worked out fine because I had the philosophy of all the news department, plus the hands-on experience in the production department. Had carried a paper out my whole life, a weekly paper.
Yeah.
And I had a broad breadth of experiences, so sure. I just kind of fell into it, really.
Yeah.
It worked out fine for me. But then I became the publisher of the Sun when the New York Times bought it in 1971, and I published it until I retired in 85.
Retired in 1985.
Yeah, and then I went into a real estate career. In the meantime, my wife had been buying property, started buying some property. I remember I came back from one of my trips. I was had a lot of responsibility. We had 33 small newspapers, and I was traveling a lot then. And I came back one time from a trip and said, I bought a house while you were gone, a little two-bedroom house. We still own it, in fact. But she started accumulating some real estate and enjoyed doing that. And, the people that she'd been working with closed the drugstore, and it's now a parking lot. It was on 4th Avenue across from the old hospital, which now is gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, that's kind of...
So that was your career was basically in journalism from the start. Yeah.
And I graduated when I left in February of 85. It wasn't February, it was August of 85. I left the newspaper work. I went out and talked to Ralph Lowenstein, the dean of the journalism school. I knew him real well and told him about it. He said, I've got to start you right now. He said, I got something open I can put you in. And I started teaching an advertising course as an adjunct professor. And I did that for a year. And then after that, I started teaching a course in newspaper management, which I had a lot of experience in. And I was teaching it to editorial writers so they'd better understand what was going on. I taught that for a year. And then I decided I just didn't want to keep up with a real estate career. I was getting a lot of some advanced training in real estate. And I just didn't more than I wanted to try to handle it. So I dropped. And I turned loose the newspaper at that time completely.
Ralph, by the way, says to say hello.
Oh, I like Ralph a lot.
He's a neighbor of mine, and we play tennis on Sundays.
Last time I saw Ralph, he and I were in heart rehab together out there.
Yeah.
We both had a heart attack. I'd have been at 06. I see you. No, 04.
Yeah. Maybe. He's part of a regular Sunday morning tennis group that I'm part of.
Okay.
And I happened to mention to him that I was going to be interviewing. He said, oh, say hello to Bill.
Yeah, so, I like it. And brought you a nice post.
Yeah. We talked a little about your marriage and your family. Did you want to say more about it? I know you're...
Well, actually, my wife was graduated in 51, worked for Julian Canova at the Canova Prescription Center. When I first started out working for Ernest Campbell, and worked for about a year and a half. And then she would go horrendous hours. She'd work from 8:30 to 6 one day, and then from 3 o'clock to 11 the next day. And then 8:30 to 6. She did that with no days off. And working 60 or 70 hours a week. And it really got to be a lot of pressure. Then she had an opportunity, one of the doctor's friends, she talked to Julian Canova, ran Canova Prescription Center. And she worked there from up until about 1970-75. And very good as a pharmacist. She started having memory problems toward the end of the 1990s. Started having some accidents with cars, got mixed up on where she was, got lost in Utah. I knew it was coming on.
And did you have children?
Yeah, I have two children. I have a daughter that lives in Virginia. She has two children. She was born in 1954. And my son was born in 1965. And he's up in Atlanta. He's never gotten married. My daughter has been married now for, close to 20 years.
I see.
And has two children. And they live in Virginia. Just came down here last week. But they're getting along fine.
I just wanted to ask you, just back up one second. You mentioned briefly the GI Bill. Was that an important part of?
Well, it was necessary, really.
You and people in your generation.
Yeah, it's very important. It was $90 a month, as I recall, but that made the difference between being able to do it or not do it. And then that way, I could. Some of my jobs, I always had a job. I'm pleased with the fact that I never had to take any money from my folks. Because they were lived rather frugally, didn't have a big business or a big income, and so I was able to even up to getting me in college to start with, I had money I'd save from all my paper routes, and weekend work and everything, and so I never had to lean on them for anything, but it was a good experience for me to do, but the GI Bill was very important. I remember one. Right after I got out of the Army, I went down to Arcadia And all my friends were talking, went out hunting and fishing and everything. I said, how do you do that? I said, well, we got a 5220 club. They gave me $20 a week for 52 weeks. They said, come on, get yours. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And I went down to the courthouse, and I had to sign something saying that I attempted to find work and could not find anything. And I said, I can't sign that. I said, I've got a job waiting on me down there at the newspaper. My father's already wants me to stay and work down there. I said, I'd love to take off after all this, but getting out of the service, going through a semester of college, and then it'd be nice to have the summer off. But I said, no, thank you, and I never did do that.
This was 52 weeks of unemployment compensation for $20 a week.
$20 a week. Yeah. I remember they called it 5220. Yeah. So I wouldn't make it but $20 a week to work it.
Yeah. Did your military training and experience play a positive role in your life and your career?
I'm sure it did. Yeah, I'm sure it did. That it brings to the forefront a whole lot of things that you learn. And again, I think that my Boy Scout training was really important to me because I think it's important that I felt like I was confident that I could take care of myself. I think it has a lot to do with it. It kept me from being afraid about anything. I just felt like, you know, and that's been with me the whole time now. And I'm looking back on all the things that have had an effect on my life. That's been one of them.
I see. Yeah. Is there anything else that we should have covered, but we didn't?
Not really. I get some individual experiences of flying that were, when I think back about it, I think, well, I was pretty lucky for those. One of these that I had mentioned was that my flight leader, his name was Tom Desjardins, his last name was Desjardins, was in flight of four planes, and I was flying the fourth plane on that day, and we were out over the inland sea, and he decided he was going to attack an aircraft carrier in the inland sea. We were flying about 15,000 feet, and he started diving down toward this, one plane after the other, and I was the fourth plane. And they shot a little bit and pulled out and shot a little bit. But the fourth plane, I had to get the third plane out of the way before I could shoot anything. And I was going straight down at full throttle. And it's the fastest I've ever been in the airplane. But it approaches what we call compressibility. It begins to lurch. And I was getting in compressibility. And I pulled out. But the worst blackout I've been ever. It's a funny feeling because you can feel everything around you, but it's just like being in a totally black room. You don't know where you are. But unfortunately, the blackout happens at the point of pulling up out here where the force really applies. So I knew I was going up, I knew where I was. But I did black out, and I learned since then that some planes had done similar things and lost their wings, both of them. Yeah. And I said, that was a good airplane I had.
Yeah.
But that was important. One other time I came across a couple of the close calls I had. One of them was we got an air raid on the island, and my eager beaver friend and I were well across the island, and the air raid started sounding, meaning we're about to have an air attack. And so Al Wally said, come on, Bill, let's get up in the air. And I said, okay. So we stole a Jeep. I don't know where. Somebody had a Jeep there. They didn't left the keys in it. We jumped in their Jeep, rode over to our airstrip, got out, got in our planes, and took off. We said, if they're going to have an air attack, we want to be up there, not down here on the ground. And so we did. We took off. But starting to take off, we took off from two planes at a time in formation. And I was in positioning about 30 feet behind and maybe 50, 60 feet abroad like this on the plane, on the strip. And I realized my shoulder harness wasn't fastened. Now we had the planes were fully loaded, ready for a mission. They had full armament, full gasoline, full everything. And my plane started, my shoulder harness wasn't fast. I took my hand off the throttle to lock my shoulder harness, put it back on the throttle. In the meantime, I got a little bit further back, and the prop wash from this plane was against your mind. And my plane started turning into to the left. And there was a big cliff over there where they had hacked out the part of the thing. And so I had to cut the throttle to straighten out the plane. And here I was with this loaded plane going then close to flying speed, but not quite at flying speed. and I got it straight, and I had an instant make a decision: was I going to cut it back and try to stop it, or was I going to push the throttle forward and try to get it off the ground? And I chose to try to get it off the ground. But I was staggering off the end of the runway and nosed it down. We had about a 200-foot drop off the runway into the ocean and dropped it down to get the extra flying speed I needed. But then we circled the island to burn up some of that fuel before we could come back. But that was one time that I was frightened.
Yeah.
I wasn't frightened of inactivity, but yeah. But I realized in retrospect that was a pretty close
one. Sounds like it.
One other one we had was that I remember vividly was we had flown back. My flight, my squadron was strafing an airfield. And in Japan, and I've gotten in my ride of in my log the name of the airfield. But four planes are usually assigned as top cover for two or three years. One of them is to keep anybody up there from attacking those planes that are coming across the strafe at low altitude. The other one is just to detract the people at the airfield, to give them something to do while the planes are getting ready to shoot out on here. But I was in the top cover that day, and they were had some anti-aircraft fire, and the fellow I was flying with was only about 40, 50 yards away from me. I was probably closer than it could be to a loose formation. But he was hit by the anti-aircraft fire. He started losing his coolant. And so we started and turned out going toward Ewell. And we got out every 150 miles. In the 650 miles from Iwo to Japan, they have 150 miles out from Iwo, they have a naval vessel. And we had radio contact with that vessel. And so we could call them up, we had had to identify them. And then the next 150 miles, they had another vessel. Usually, right off the coast of Japan, right on our route of where we were heading, a submarine would surface while we were on our mission. And we could contact the submarine. They would come pick us up if we had to bail out right off the coast. They would stay on the surface. We had a flight of four planes, usually protecting the submarine, too. I never did get on one of those. But anyway, we started back, and we passed the submarine, and then out 150. And he got to the second one. He said, "I think I can go one more." He was losing his coolant. It's an inline engine. You have to have it to try. He got partway toward the second one. He said, "I got to leave." And so he did what he's supposed to do. He dropped his wheels, put down some flaps, jettisoned his canopy, and he rolled over the side. When he did, he hit the horizontal stabilizer, which is the tailpipe. He hit this thing. He rolled out here on the left side. He stalled it up here. And hit that when he hit
it. So that would be like, I would say, like tail fin. They don't call it that.
It's a stabilizer. It's a horizontal. But that's what he hit. And I could see him hit it and then go under. And I circled and out there and never find any evidence of it. But the flight leader and I circled out there for an extra 30 or 40 minutes with identifying our position and identifying his position, waiting on some Navy people to come. And that was about as long as we could wait. Then we started back to Iwo. And just the two of us, sometimes we had B-29 escorts back home. They usually would, on a normal mission, would circle out over the submarine, wait on us there. And we had radio contact with the B-29. And so we could, and we also had a homing device. We call it Uncle Dog. It's the UD. In Morse code, U is dot dot dash, and D is dash dot dot, and you lay them over top, and you get a overlying solid signal. And so you could home in on the B-29, say, give us a signal, and they'd give us a carrier wave, and we could home in on it on the B-29. But that's an aside. Anyway, I waited there. When they didn't come, we had to start back to Iwo, just the two of us. And I called Jose, and I said, "Jose, we're about to pass Iwo." I said, "We're way, way too far north. That's too far south." And he said, "Bill, I've had some trouble with my navigation equipment." He said, "Let me fly on your wing, and so we turned around almost 90 degrees and headed back to Iwo. And I had a 5-minute supply of gas. They told me when I got back.
Wow.
The P-50 was a hard one to ditch in the water because of the scoop. It would grab the...
And the underbelly, on the undercarriage.
The underbelly there. In fact, we were told the best thing to do is get it down to when you're ready to stall it, get almost to stall it, and then dip the wing in the water, and it'll cartwheel. And that's the best chance you got of getting it to
because the, short. Yeah. Otherwise, it would sort of flip it over, I guess, huh?
Yeah. And just submarine it, or just want to go down.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the... So my daughter painted that for me.
But you never, there's a doorbell, I think.